This is Lawrence Tuning, and these are my 88 friends.
Me and my 88 friends. Me and my 88 friends. I will sing you a song that will help me along. They're my one-man band. I'm the number one fan. Me and my 88. Me and my 88.
Welcome again to Me and My 88 Friends. This is our 64th episode. I'm so glad you're there listening to me right now. I'm going to interview a very, very close friend in this show today. And he goes all the way back to my very, very early days of singing and traveling, writing songs and taking the gospel. And I wrote this song as sort of a snapshot of that era in my life. And I want to start the show with it. It's called Trying to Obey the Call.
Let's go back to where it all began. Me and my friends back in Indiana form a three-piece band, bass, drums, and piano, that's all. We didn't sound half bad, we didn't sound red hot, but we prayed real hard and we practiced a lot. We were singing for Jesus, trying to obey the call. We traveled all around, for better or worse, in a 1959 Cadillac hearse. The ride was smooth, but the tires were bald. Going town to town on a wing and a prayer. Didn't make much money, but we didn't care. It was all for Jesus, trying to obey the call. Nixon in the White House, hippies in the streets. Some people called us the Jesus freaks. And I have to admit, we were caught up in it all. Songs got better and her hair grew long, and the Jesus movement kept coming on strong. And all the while we were trying to obey the law. We would ride into town in the afternoon, set up the equipment and get in tune. Then we'd gather in a circle and pray for the fire to fall. Pray to Jesus, help us tonight as we sing these songs with all our might. If we reach one person, Lord, it's worth it all.
My guest today is my great friend Larry Hughes from St. Louis, Missouri. Larry started out his career with the intention of becoming a Presbyterian pastor. However, God had another plan and led him into teaching high school students at a large Christian school. Larry's one of those friends that I love to be around because we talk about all sorts of things. We laugh a lot, and he has just a great testimony and great insights on a lot of different subjects. So I want us to go straight to our telephone interview, which we had about a week ago. My guest this week is my great friend, and I truly mean great friend, Larry Hughes, who lives in St. Louis, Missouri. I never know whether to say St. Louis or St. Louis, but I've known Larry since 1970, and he's got a very interesting life, an interesting story. My wife told me the other day about our show. She came up with this phrase, which I thought was great, and it was ordinary people with extraordinary stories, and that's really true. Everybody's got an extraordinary story, in my opinion.
Amen to that.
So this is Larry Hughes. And first of all, Larry, how do the natives say? Is it St. Louis or St. Louis?
You know, I think jazz musicians probably say St. Louis, but like the St. Louis Blues. But most people around here say St. Louis.
Have you ever met anybody named Louis in your town?
No. How about that?
There was an old song, Meet Me in St. Louis, Louis.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That was Judy Garland.
Yes, it was. Now, I like talking to you because you can ride with me anywhere I go. You know about my ADD, and so anything I come up, you're interested. So let's talk about you. You don't have a Missouri accent. You come from East Tennessee.
That's exactly right. Kingsport.
Kingsport, Tennessee. I was going to say Dolly Parton country, but you're not quite over there. It's more Tennessee Ernie Ford country, right?
That's right. Exactly right, because Tennessee Ernie was from Bristol, although Dolly Sevierville is pretty doggone close.
You know, Larry, we'll probably cut this out, but Andre Crouch told me one time, and I was so happy. He said, "Your singing voice sounds like somebody really famous." I thought, wow, he's going to say it's Elton John. He said, "I can't put my finger on it, but it's somebody famous." I'm thinking he's going to say James Taylor, or he might say Elton John, you know, or Paul McCartney. And finally, I was like, half hour later, he says, "I got it, Tennessee Ernie Ford." I said, "Oh, he's not cool. He's my parents' age." But anyway, Tennessee Ernie was a great singer, but he wasn't cool in the 70s, at least.
He was definitely great. He was a great comedian, too.
Yes, so. He was. I Love Lucy. Okay, let's talk about you. Kingsport, right. Tennessee, eastern corner of Tennessee, near Bristol and Johnson City.
The Tri-Cities, yep.
Do you know anything about your family heritage? Did they always live in that area? Where did they come from? You know anything about them? My guess is the Hughes are Scottish, right?
Certainly my mother's name, Duncan, was Scottish, Scots-Irish. But that part of the country was settled heavily by Scots and Irish. My grandfather, who I really didn't know, he passed away when I was two. His name was Hugh Banner Duncan.
Oh, my.
So, yeah, but yeah, my family, we never really had family reunions because everybody still lived in that area on both sides of the family. So, you know, they saw one another. We're in and out of one another's homes all the time.
But do you know when they came to America?
No, that's something I've never – I've always thought, knowing my family, they may have been running from the law.
Your father was – a factory worker, is that right?
Right. He worked at the Tennessee Eastman, which for maybe still is, for all I know, for a long time was the largest industrial business in the state of Tennessee. So it was Eastman Kodak, and then they split off and made all sorts of different things.
So you grew up there in Kingsport with two parents and one brother.
My brother, Philip. And, he's 5 years younger.
And did you like living out in a little town in Tennessee?
I loved Kingsport. And I mean, I was never one of those things where I wanted to, that I was, couldn't wait to leave home. Kingsport was a great place to grow up. I had really, you know, great friendships. I had a great church experience. And of course it's beautiful. I mean, you know, it was just wonderful for everything.
When is the first time you ever felt a drawing toward God?
Somebody asked me about this several weeks back. The story I always tell is that my mom and dad, of course, from the time I was little, they always took us to church. They read us Bible stories and that sort of thing. And my favorite Bible story was that of David and Jonathan. And Jonathan was the focus on it for me. I just couldn't understand, because I felt very much loved as a child. I couldn't understand. I asked my parents, how could Jonathan love someone outside his own family, that is David, even more than he would love and care for himself? Because Jonathan was in line to be king, and yet he loved David with this great love. And I asked my mom and dad, I was just little, I said, how can you love somebody outside your family more than your family? And this was really the beginning, I think, of God drawing me. My parents, when I asked that question, how can you love somebody outside your own family more than someone in your family? They simply said, we don't know. But they followed that up with this. They really presented the gospel to me as parents right then. They said, we don't know, but that's how God loves us, which is exactly what, you know, the Bible says, you know, for God so loved the world, he gave his only son. So I just was flabbergasted by that as a little kid. And I'm sure I couldn't have put it in these words then, but I thought, if that's true, that God loves me more than even his own son, that he's willing to die, then the most important thing in the world must be to know that God. And so that was the beginning of being drawn, and that became the question really for my whole life. How can you come to know God and follow him? Because he must be the most wonderful God in the world.
So how old were you when that, around how old were you when that happened?
Probably 5 or 6, because matter of fact, I'm sure it's probably 5, because my mom was probably expecting my brother, because at the point I asked that question, he was not there.
Right. Okay.
Like I said, yeah.
So was there a moment that you can point to where you, as we say, accepted Christ, got saved, born again, whatever term you want to use, where you were, sure.
There's, for me, it was when I was 12 years old, and probably because of the way the Lord had worked their life and the way that he led. When I was 12, they had a Christmas play at the Baptist church we were going to, and we had pretty much gone to the Baptist church all the time, the Southern Baptist church, growing up. And they didn't just do the typical, you know, Christmas story of the birth of Jesus and all that. They actually amazingly started in Eden. And so they gave a basic presentation of the gospel from the fall to the resurrection of Christ. And when they were, the fellow that was playing Jesus, when they were hanging him on the cross, he began to weep. And all of a sudden, I realized, I thought, wait a minute. What my mom and dad have told me about, this is not just something they told me, this is mine as well. And that night, you know, I asked Jesus to come into my heart, you know, and had that experience. And that was just one more step along the way of God drawing me along. Nowadays, in the point of view of it, I would consider myself a covenant child, that I was brought into that relationship with God through my mom and dad, my parenting. And then at a certain point, I realized, you know, through the Holy Spirit speaking into my heart, saying, this is for you. Jesus died for you and rose again. So that was when I would put it, at the time I was 12.
Now, I'm just curious, this guy on the cross, Was he really crying, or was that part of the drama?
He was really crying. He was really crying. I think that was the what, you know, it wasn't an intentional thing. I doubt if anybody was that good of an actor. And he just really, you know, and that idea of Jesus sorrowful for the sins of the world and you know, what he had to endure to do that. But a love that was so great, just weeping over us.
Yeah.
So that was how it affected me.
Well, who knows? He might have wept on the cross because he wept on Palm Sunday. We know that.
Exactly.
So,
and yeah.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, yeah. And so, like, when Jesus is standing outside Jerusalem and says, you know, how often I would have gathered you as a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, but you would not have it. And, you know, Jesus, and he wept outside the tomb of Lazarus. So, yeah, very, very much true.
I'm back with my friend, the Reverend Larry Hughes. I've never called you Reverend.
That's the right Reverend, as the Puritans like to say.
You are interesting to me because, I mean, I know you played in the band. I think you were a trumpet player, weren't you?
Exactly right. Ooh.
But I've never known you to sing, but I never know anybody that loves music and has such an eclectic music taste as you. And where does that come from?
Well, certainly growing up, you know, in the 60s, there was so much music happening. I mean, my teen years were, you know, filled with that sort of thing. And I really liked music because for me, it joined, I didn't even realize this until my 30s, that it put together my thinking along with my feelings or my emotions. So a really great song unites you as a person because it makes that emotional connection, whether you're talking about sorrows or joys or hopes and dreams. But also, you know, a good lyric helped to sort of focus and say what I was thinking as well. So that became it was a huge comfort as well as a huge learning experience to listen to different kinds of music. And I think that to me, I think part of it's just the time I grew up in, but that's probably true. Most people would probably say that maybe for any time that they grew up.
Right. Okay. Who's your favorite male rock and roll singer of all time?
My favorite male rock and roll singer of all time. Wow. Oh man, that's hard. As far as a singer goes, probably Paul Carrack.
Who? Paul who?
Carrack. Carrack.
See, I like to hang around you. I have no idea who that is.
Well, he's had a successful solo career, but he has sort of been a voice for hire for a lot of bands because he's sung for like Mike and the Mechanics. His first big record, I listened to, was when I was in high school, it's the Ace song, How Long?
He wrote that?
No, yeah, he wrote that. But then he sang like for...
Did he sing it? Was he the singer?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I saw him. You're right. He was a wonderful singer.
He's still going great guns today. I love his stuff.
He sang at a Eric Clapton concert that I went to. Hey, good choice. I thought you were going to say Elvis. Who was your favorite female vocalist of all time?
Oh, that's got to be Emmylou Harris.
Okay. Favorite band of all time?
Well, that's got to be the Beatles. I mean, there's just no way around it. For the variety, the breadth of their work in terms of, you know, rock and roll as well as all the way over to, you know, really experimental or advanced things. I mean, one of my buddies asked me one time if I had to get rid of all the music I had but one, what would I keep? I said, well, the Beatles, because it covers the waterfront.
Well, thanks a lot. Yeah. I really appreciate that. My records go in the trash pile.
No. It was if you were limited to one thing. Well, you didn't have, well, put it this way. At that point, when I got asked that question, you only had like four records out, I think. So
thanks for rubbing it.
Well, yeah, but you've done what I think great artists do. You have gotten better and better, and you've had, as a result, you've had a lot more recordings late in your career, like even the last few years. Great stuff.
You're a nice guy. I'm averaging one every 8 years, and I've been telling the Lord, God, I don't know how many eight-year spans are left. But, okay, I was going to ask you something else about, favorite song.
Favorite song. Boy, that's hard. That's really hard. I mean, goodness gracious. Can you hone it in into a particular style?
Favorite country song. We'll leave it at that.
Oh, that's got to be Hank Williams, "I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry."
Interesting. Okay, now let's keep it spiritual. We have to keep it spiritual.
Sure,
Larry. Favorite, and leave Lawrence shooting out. You know, my ego will can handle this. Favorite Christian song. Let's make it two questions. Favorite hymn, old Christian song, and favorite, we'll say, Christian song of the in your lifetime that came out.
Okay. My favorite hymn is "Come Thou Fount of Every Blessing."
Why?
Well, because it's such a great hymn about gratitude and about the fact the way that God's moved, and it speaks, as it goes into the last verse, what I think anybody as a Christian struggles. It says, as the believer sings the song, says, "Prone to wander, Lord, I feel it. Prone to leave the God I love. Here's my heart, Lord, take and seal it. Seal it for thy courts above." I think, you know, that's left on our own. That's what we do, is we tend to wander off from this God who's been so wonderful to us, and yet he pursues us and will not let us go. So that's one of those songs I can sing all. Matter of fact, I was thrilled. We sang it at church last Sunday as the first hymn. Now let's see, modern Christian song. And you said to leave yours out. Wow, that's. let me think. I suppose I'm probably going to have to go with something by Larry Norman. So I'll probably go with "Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music?" Because that was a question that was asked all the way back even into Luther's times.
Let's go back to when you and I met. We met in the summer of 1970.
Yes, and you were traveling as the fisherman carrying the gospel out into all the world. And
we had just left Indiana in July 1st of that year. So we were headed, I think, toward Washington, D.C. or Norton, Virginia. And I still don't know why we stopped in Kingsport. I know we knew of Judy, who was a college friend who lived in Kingsport. But do you remember when we met?
We met, certainly at the First Church of God in Kingsport, which was one of the growing, thriving churches in Kingsport, that taught about Jesus very well. I was in a just an exceptionally strong youth group of people that were excited about knowing the Lord, and you came through at that time, and once again it wedded those things that were so important to me. My thinking, my feeling, and just that love for Jesus.
And God knit our hearts together from about the first time we met.
That's absolutely true. We've kept a friendship. I was thinking about that the other day. You know, we've been friends for 52 years.
That's
because I was 16 when we met.
You were 16. He was only 16. Anyway, and if you remember, we won't call names now, but I got thrown out of the church.
You were singing "Going Out of My Head."
Yeah, so. I think Judy, our friend Judy, she knew that I could play the songs on the radio because we went to college together, and I think she put me up to it. And I probably played some Boogie Woogie and all of that, but she said that. Play "Going Out of My Head."
That was Judy, yeah. Which was perfect to me because, here all of a sudden, because we were in church, you were playing the piano, and certainly you sang some hymns, and you sang some of your early songs, and then you sang, that great rock and roll song, "Going Out of My Head." And, that was just one more of those expressions of sort of the fullness of what a life meant.
I think I'm going out of my head. Well, we didn't know the pastor was around. And tell my crowd what the pastor did and what he said. He was livid. He was mad.
We were in the sanctuary by ourselves. It might even have been a Saturday evening, and the pastor was stepped in at the back of the sanctuary, and he had this most wonderful just voice. I mean, as an orator or a preacher, and he said, "Well, I think I'm going out of my head too. What's going on?"
He shut me down. You know, I was thinking about that. I've been thrown out of more than one place in my time. I remember I was at Anderson University, and I walked in this auditorium. They had this grand piano getting ready to have a classical concert, and nobody was there. And I told my friend, I said, "Let me show you how Jerry Lee Lewis can play the piano with his feet." And so I had my foot playing. Oh, my gosh, one of the head of the music department threw me out. He was mad.
So I can just see that.
I don't think I could reach my foot to the keyboard nowadays. But
I was going to say, that must have been really at a weird time, because I've never seen you bang on the piano with your heel. I would have paid to see that.
Well, I did it, but I can't do it now. But, okay, you felt called to the ministry. And I know not everybody that's in, you know, in the old days, you felt like you had to have this supernatural experience where you had a date and a time where you felt the call. But you actually did feel a call, right?
Yeah, and yes, I did. And I think, you know, I think there were some missteps on my part. I feel like that, you know, right before I retired, I'd spent 20 years teaching here in St. Louis can I say the school's name?
Of course.
Westminster Christian Academy, which is just one of the most wonderful schools, one of the most wonderful Christian schools, I really do think, in the United States. And I was really blessed to get to teach biblical ethics, of all things, for 20 years to students. And that was, I felt like, was where I really, if you want to say, hit my stride, or I really found the place that the Lord wanted me to serve.
And we're not talking about some little school in a double-wide mobile home somewhere. This was a big high school.
It's about 1,000 students, not quite 1,000 usually, but yes, it's one of the largest, it may be the largest Christian high school in St. Louis, for all I know, but yeah, it's got a long history. It was established in 1976, the same year that I graduated from college. So,
yeah. Okay. Let's go back now. Let's go back. You felt a call to the ministry at what age?
That must have been, I don't know, certainly in my teen years. That would have a much harder time pinning down. I don't know if it was before I met you or after I met you, but it would be somewhere right there, let's say between 15 and 17, that area.
Okay, and I know from talking to you in the past, and I don't remember the details, but you had an experience with the Lord sitting in the bottom of an empty baptismal pool. Is that right?
Yeah, the Church of God had a really nice baptism pool with a below in the basement, the place where that people would, you know, put on their robes to be baptized. So, yeah.
I remember the Lord brought a specific verse to you.
Well, it was the parts of it, the main thing I always remember is the verse, because it's been one of the things that has kept me focused. I read just John. I've always loved, and the older I get, the more I love Jesus last night with the disciples when he's speaking to them before he's going to be crucified. And in John 15, verse 16, he says, "You didn't choose me, I chose you." And, you know, that was kind of, that just meant, I felt like that, okay, God's really involved in my life. And that reaffirmed that whole thing I'd heard even with my parents. That's the way that he loves us. He's the most important. And so the pursuit of that has been, you know, feeling confident that the Lord had called me to be his.
And weren't you going through a kind of time of doubting and that verse just sealed the deal.
That was that. Yeah, I think as I was, certainly I was no stranger to all the experiences of folks in the 60s in terms of wondering what's true and what's not true, and following on and struggling to understand how that both your, for lack of a better term, your head and your heart went together, your thinking and your emotions. And that just sort of reaffirmed for me that, that Jesus called me, and since he's the one that called me, he would bring it to pass.
Right.
And my goal was to work to follow him, not to earn anything, because I think it's James, it's not who the author is, that says we don't earn anything. We work, but we're already saved by God's grace, and he leads us on. So it's the idea of being a disciple, of actively following and doing what you can to do that.
And Larry, I like the rest of that verse, which you didn't mention, but the rest of that verse says, I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit. And the last part is what I really like, that your fruit would remain.
That's been so important because, everybody asks themselves, especially at this point that we've gotten to in our lives, well, have I been a good disciple? Have I done something that God has used me for to be a blessing and to lead others to him? And that's what you have to rely on. And certainly my experience with you as a young man, and as I grew, and as our relationship, our friendship grew, and you were certainly a mentor to me. Hopefully, at this point, hopefully I'm part of that fruit that remains that you brought, that the Lord has used you to do.
Well, there's no hope about it. I mean, you are, and I'm very proud to be your friend. You did spend a period of time in Switzerland with Francis Schaeffer.
That's right. When I was going to college, again, struggling and asking questions, but I felt sure that Jesus was real and that Christianity was truth with a capital T. But I was really trying to figure out how to, again, bring your thinking and your emotions to be united as a whole person. And one of my friends, it might have been you, said, with the kind of questions you ask, you should probably read Francis Schaeffer. And I did not know who Francis Schaeffer was, but that led me to buying some of those books. And all of a sudden, I felt like, yeah, this is, Christianity has real intellectual integrity as well as emotional power. And so at that point, I thought, well, I'm not sure, but I would love to go study at Le Brie in Switzerland. And I met my wife, and we determined that was something we would do together. So we worked, saved a bunch of money, and moved to Switzerland and lived and studied Le Brie for 3 months and then traveled around Europe. But Dr. Schaeffer was instrumental in helping me pick a seminary where I would go to school to get my graduate degree. And that led us to St. Louis and to Covenant Theological Seminary. And also, we knew where we would go to church before we even got here. We would go to Grace and Peace Fellowship Presbyterian Church, which we've been at pretty much ever since we got here in 1981, except for about a year and a half when we lived in Florida.
Larry, you probably don't remember this, but I remember when you started dreaming maybe we could go to Le Brie one day. I think I gave you like $1 or $5. It was a very minuscule amount, But I remember saying, this is seed faith. Here's my seed.
Yes, you did do that. Yes, you did. It's funny you mentioned that because that had slipped my mind. But that's, yes, you did do that. Well, like I say, you've always have been not just a friend, but a mentor. And you've always been really good about that, about in terms of, I think of you as like a Barnabas-like figure that invests in people and brings them along. And, I'm sure that Paul had to apologize to Barnabas when they met up here in heaven again, after the fight they had over John Mark. Barnabas was great. Paul was wrong.
My aunt was the sheriff of a county in South Carolina. Her husband was the sheriff. He died. The governor made her the sheriff. But they used to live in the jailhouse. Back in the old days, a deputy would have an apartment hooked onto the jail, and the deputy would live there, and his wife would cook for the prisoners. And so there was one preacher that was thrown. He was a preacher. He was thrown in jail on a Saturday night. He was drunk. And on Sunday morning, he woke up and he says, "Where am I?" They said, "You're in jail." He says, "I'm supposed to preach in an hour. I've got to get out of here." They said, "You're not having court till Monday." And so after a while, after that shock wore off, he stood up and started preaching to the prisoners. And this is a true story. One of the prisoners at some point yelled, interrupted the sermon and said, he had his words mixed up. He said, "Hey, if you're so tight with God, why don't you pray an earthquake comes and opens these jail doors like the impossible Paul did in the Bible?" He meant the apostle Paul, but he said the impossible. I'm sure Barnabas probably thought he was the impossible Paul at times.
And I'm sure of that too.
Larry.
Yes.
So we don't need to go in specifics, and maybe you don't want to talk about this, but at some point you tried your hand. I won't say that's not the right way to say it. You did the traditional route of being groomed to be you were like an assistant pastor in a traditional church. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I think that's, like I say, as God led, I'm grateful for that experience. When I graduated from seminary, you know, that was just what you basically did, was that you looked for a church to work in. And so, I accepted the job, to work at a Presbyterian church. And, you know, I was not cut out to be a pastor, I'm sure, for that. But it was, you know, God was so kind. There's so many good things that came out of that. And actually, I had one of my favorite, I don't know if you want to call it experiences or memories, at that church before I came back to St. Louis and ultimately went into teaching at a Christian school.
So you were there, what, a year and a half?
Yeah.
It wasn't a good experience, right, when you left, if I remember right.
It was a hard experience. But like I say, that was one of those times that, you know, you wondered, well, it made you, as I think any Christian does, you know, you have times in your life where you're trying to figure out, you're struggling in your faith, and it was a really hard time. It took me several years after that to see that anything good that I felt had come out of it. And yet, you know, there was testimonies from other people that there were good things that came out of it. So, you know, there was fruit there that has endured, that certainly that I wasn't even aware of for a long time.
Well, you're just a traditional thinking guy, you know, and my guess is you probably had some innovative approaches that didn't fit the traditional mold. I've never talked to you much about that. But then there was a long period, right, where you just entered the workforce.
Yeah. Well, when we started our family, I was praying for the job I had. I was working, and I really loved it. I was working in a research program, but I had to work every holiday and every weekend because the, you know, I could get up and go to church early on Sunday morning and go into to the lab in the afternoon. But when we started our family, I wanted to be able to obviously have the weekends and holidays off to be with my children. And so I started to pray about a, the next place I would go. And God just really graciously, as he always does, I wound up with a new job, totally unrelated to just the mere fact that I was taking a graduate class in Shakespeare. And one of the people I was taking the class with asked me how things were going. And I said, well, I'm having to look for a new job. And that led me into the next job. So, and so I wound up with business experience, but all of my previous experiences had prepared me for that experience. And I really learned a lot through that time in business. And I had the opportunity to see that, you know, serving the Lord was far bigger than, quote, being in ministry and that kind of thing, that there's absolutely, you know, as it says in Colossians, whatever you do, do it unto the glory of God. And, you know, in 1 Corinthians 10:31 too, you know, so whether you eat or drink or whatever you do, do it to the glory of God. So you can do that, whether you're a preacher or you're a teacher or a doctor or a lawyer, anything.
Okay. You became an insurance man, right?
That's right. Well, not a sales guy. I became a, claim representative, and I handled bodily injury claims in auto accidents.
How many years did you do that?
11.
Okay. Did you ever, during that time, and I know what you just said, that you learned sort of the priesthood of all believers, you're a minister wherever you are, but did you ever wonder, God, have I missed it? Have I missed my call? I went to seminary, and now I'm a claims adjuster for an insurance company?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I've been thinking a lot. I'm really glad that I've had all the experiences that I've had, because the one thing that I've constantly seen is that God is faithful, that he will not abandon us. And so I had the opportunity at some really weird and odd occasions to be able to share my faith, as well as to just live in such a way that it affected other people.
Right.
And not because I was anything great, but just because, you know, I was trying to be a disciple and follow.
Right. I remember talking to a lady who was cutting my hair and beard years ago. She was a Christian. She says, oh, I wish I could quit this job, and I wish I could just go out and evangelize. And I remember telling her, why would you do that? You're literally rubbing shoulders with people from this whole county, and you're able to share the Lord right here. You're more effective here than you would be walking up and down the streets. But then there came this moment, Larry, and I'm moving towards something here, when you, in my opinion, you found your niche. When I found out your new career, I thought, yeah, that's what he was born to do. That was probably the calling. You know, when we were growing up, when people would say, I'm called to the ministry, the only thing that people thought of is you're either going to be a pastor or a missionary.
Exactly, yes.
But when I found out what you spent the last 20 years of your life doing, I just knew this is cut out for Larry. This was God's plan all along, and he did this and that and the other, but he's really landed now at the fullness of his calling. Can you talk about that?
Yeah. Well, the one thing, because I've always loved to read and to study, and so being able to go into teaching was just a dream come true. As I've told them that when I was leaving, you know, retiring from my job, I never had a day where I dreaded going to work. I always knew there'd be challenges, there'd be difficulties, but there was just as the insurance place I was working was reorganizing, I'd been praying because I didn't feel like I needed to stay there. And we were out to dinner, actually, with some old seminary friends, and she said, we just always got together and just had a wonderful time. She said, if you could do anything in the world, what would you do? And I said, I'd love to be able to teach, especially English. And she just said, well, I'll start to pray about that. And over the next couple of months, it just transpired that all of a sudden I was offered this opportunity to teach both biblical ethics as well as English. And it was just a dream come true. And after I'd been there a year or two, I said, you know, if you are ever interested in me going full time into biblical ethics, I would love that. And I wound up doing that, and then yet still was able to keep my toe in the water of English. So I taught freshman writing. I taught literature of Western civilization 1 year, along with the biblical ethics class I was teaching. And I also had the opportunity to teach in the English department film as literature, where that we explored storytelling in that way. But
did you ever do a study on the movie Dude, Where's My Car?
No, we never quite got there. We did all sorts of famous films as well as more modern films. Of course, you know, we watched things like The Maltese Falcon. And then in the more modern time, we watched like The Fugitive, and it was a blast.
So you did that for like, I think you said 20 years.
Yeah. The last two decades of my work life were doing that. And it was just one of the staff at the school, I guess he'd be the comptroller, was asking me one day, I said, this has been a dream come true. Never in my wildest imagination would I have been able to come up with a job where I got to teach English as well as teaching Bible, as well as it was a joy.
I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall to hear you teach. That would have been great.
Part of what we need to do as Christians is listen to what questions people are asking, and then show them how that the faith actually answers those questions. How that Jesus is exactly who he said he was. He did what he did, and he's definitely coming back.
This has been a great experience, having this conversation with my friend Larry Hughes. We're going to definitely have him back on the show more than once because he has a lot to say, and we didn't even talk about his experiences as a teacher. But thank you, Larry, for joining us, and thank all of you for listening to our show. The one thing that really spoke to me as I listened to Larry talk was the sovereignty of God and how God leads us along, even when we go around a zigzag path. If we're leaning on Him, trusting Him, He always lands us at the right place. So God bless. Hope you join us next week.